When the coat was removed from the body while the medium's hands were held by adjacent sitters, it was found that an elastic armlet the medium wore above the elbow was outside a rope, that is, the rope that had been tied over the coat in the first tying up was underneath the elastic armband. To do this normally, the end of the sewn and sealed rope must have been freed, all knotting undone to the armband and then threaded through, the knotting and binding restored and the end sewn up and sealed with the signet ring of the sitter. Later on, when the coat was returned to the medium's body, the rope was freed from the armlet and left outside the coat as originally tied. The guide later explained that the armlet had been dematerialized when the coat was taken off and rematerialized outside the rope. When the coat was being replaced, the process had to be reversed to enable the rope to be freed to be placed outside the coat. Another method that has been used is to employ sensitive roping, so that if the medium ever, normally, freed himself from the ropes, they would fall into one loop, impossible to replace without assistance. Repeatedly during seances, the white light is put on immediately before and after some phase of phenomena requiring rapid action. Those who roped the medium are invited by the guide to examine the ropes, etc., to see if they are precisely as originally tied. The roping has never been found to have altered, and at the end of a seance, whatever the phenomena may have been, it is exactly as tied in the beginning. The report later on by Mr. Colin Evans of one of our seances illustrates this point in detail. Roping, no matter how elaborately tied, is ineffective to keep the medium in the chair, if the guide wishes to take him out of the bonds. This feat is one of the most remarkable of those exhibited by the spirit people. The modus operandi is as follows: the light is put on to show the medium roped in the chair, the ropes and knots are examined, and the light is switched off. The next one hears is the instruction for light, which shows the medium standing on the far side of the circle. The time which has elapsed may be only a few seconds. The ropes are seen to be resting on the chair as tied, even to the crossing of one rope over another, in precisely the same position as if the medium's body was within them. In considering this process, it is interesting to remember that as a rule it takes two people from 2 to 4 minutes each to tie the medium in the ropes alone, and an appreciable time to undo the knotting, sometimes longer, especially when the knots are obstinate, than the time taken to tie him up. The return of the medium to the roped condition in the chair is also a matter of seconds, from 5 to 10. The medium is seen standing in an entranced condition away from the chair. Before the light is put out, he may be seen to be gyrating quickly. The light is extinguished, and a slight sound may be heard. There is an immediate call for light, and he is seen back in his chair, roped precisely, to the minutest detail, as before. A variation of the above is as follows: the white light is put on and the ropings are examined. Then two sitters are asked to hold the medium's hands. The light is extinguished. The sitters linked to the medium feel his hands fall over the side of the chair arm and the medium rises to his feet, out of the ropes, without exertion or jerkiness. On several occasions the medium has been levitated out of the ropes and deposited outside the circle of sitters. The sitters are close together, touching each other with their hands linked, in circle formation. The medium therefore had to be levitated into the air and carried over the sitters' heads to enable him to alight outside the circle. Sometimes on such an occasion he may be suspended in the air for a number of minutes, his feet gently resting on the shoulders of a sitter who is asked by the guide to place his hands on them and to feel up the sides of the legs. While the sitter is doing this, the ceiling may be somewhat violently knocked by the medium's head and/or hands. The interesting feature of this phenomena is that no weight is felt on the sitter's shoulders. The medium is then brought to the floor outside the circle of sitters. As a rule, this takes place at the end of a séance, and the medium is then brought to himself standing. When this occurs, the ropes are left on the chair, and efforts are made by one of the sitters to try and get into the roping. A lady and the author, both smaller boned than Mr. Weber, have unsuccessfully tried to place both arms and legs into the fastenings. Struggling takes place for a number of minutes, but even after taking the shoes off, no one has yet succeeded in doing it. When one has been able to get one arm in, it was only by displacing the ropes and rucking one's clothing. Rarely is it possible to get the coat sleeves under the ropes at all, and when the medium's upper arm was bound to the chair, the task of normal re-entry was absolutely impossible. These normal efforts made considerable noise, and it is noteworthy that when the medium is returned to the roped condition in the chair, all that is heard is one slight movement as the levitated body comes to rest on the chair, accompanied by an immediate request for light. In June 1939, three representatives of the British Broadcasting Corporation were present. They were Mr. Lotterbinier, Director of Outside Broadcasts, and Mr. John Snagg and Mr. Michael Standing, commentators. These gentlemen undertook the securing of the medium. After he had been roped, the ends of the ropes, knots, etc., were bound with cotton and knotted. An extra length of cotton was tied by Mr. Lotterbinier round the outside of the medium's forearm to the armrest of the chair, then tied round the buttons on the coat cuff, carried straight in front of the medium's body to the other side where the opposite coat cuff buttons, arm, and chair were similarly secured. During this séance, the coat was taken off while the medium's hands were held by two of these gentlemen, without the cotton being broken, examination being made in white light immediately after the coat fell to the floor. Later, the coat was returned to the body with the cotton intact and knotted around the coat cuff buttons as originally tied. At the end of a 2-hour séance, Mr. Lotterbinier was asked to thoroughly examine the cotton on the ropes and especially that in front of the body, and he declared that everything was exactly as originally tied. The guy then asked him to break the cotton in front of the medium, which he did with negligible effort. This demonstrated how the slightest tension on the cotton during the evening's phenomena would have easily broken the strand. Later experiments include the tying, after roping, of silk threads, firmly and tightly around the wrists and to the chair, knots underneath, and elbow to the back of the chair, knots at rear. At the end of the séance, the silk thread was found to be embedded in the flesh of the wrist owing to swelling. In other chapters, different methods of securing the medium are referred to. To those who still may consider that the medium may possess a technique to permit his exit and entry from the fastenings normally, there is a final aspect that forbids that supposition. At the commencement of a séance, immediately after the tying, the light is put out. Within a fraction of a second, one or two trumpets are in levitation encircling the sitters. As the levitation ends and the trumpets come to the floor, there is an immediate request for light. The trumpets may have moved several feet away from the medium and have come to rest well away from his chair. Frequently in most séances, the trumpets are lying on the floor, in positions where it is absolutely impossible for the medium to touch them without getting out of the fastenings and reaching down to pick them up. The almost instantaneous switching on of the light before and after this, and other phenomena, illustrates beyond any possible doubt whatever that supernormal means must have been employed. The guides have so perfected this rapidity of action that trumpets are often seen moving as the light goes on, and still more amazing, continuing in motion for a period while the light is on. See the description by Colin Evans of a séance, further on in this volume. 31. The main purpose of roping is the prevention of any conscious or subconscious action on the part of the medium, but it is also designed to satisfy the sitters the medium is not consciously, subconsciously, or fraudulently producing movement. The one aim of the mediumship is to provide proof of survival through supernormal action, directed by intelligences possessing a greater knowledge than we have. Special sittings in red light add further testimony to the powers of the spirit people in manipulating forces beyond human knowledge. In red light, levitation has been repeatedly observed, the medium meanwhile being bound in his chair, while articles, trumpets, etc., are moving round, up and down, twisting, turning, and performing all kinds of evolutions without any visible connection with the medium. Alternatively, the article is seen sometimes in movement, strongly held by an ectoplasmic structure emerging from the solar plexus or other part of the medium's body, the medium being seen, quite still, roped in his chair. See later chapter on ectoplasmic structures. Chapter 5, Report of a Séance by Bernard Gray, Sunday Pictorial. The séance reported took place on May 24, 1939, and occupied two pages of the Sunday Pictorial dated May 28, 1939. Mr. Gray prefaced his report with an affidavit as follows: I, Bernard Gray, of 27, Bunrise, Wembley Park, in the county of Middlesex, journalist, make oath and say as follows: 1. That my description of the incidents enumerated in the article written by me hereunto annexed and marked BG to appear in the issue of the Sunday Pictorial of the 28th day of May 1939 under the heading of I swear I saw this happen is true. 2. I further make oath and say that the incidents so described in such article did occur in my presence. This oath was sworn before a solicitor yesterday. I bound him to his chair, hand and foot, with knots and double knots which a sailor once taught me. Just to make sure he couldn't wriggle out and back without my knowing it, I tied lengths of household cotton from the ropes to the chair legs. And I sewed up the front of his jacket with stout thread. So began my second investigation into the mysteries of spiritualism. 33. The man I had trussed up was Jack Weber, formerly a Welsh miner. He's now a medium, a man for whom such remarkable claims are made that I selected him for my first test. Through him, I was told, are performed some of the most astonishing miracles of spirit power, physical demonstrations intended to prove the reality of life after death. And in this, my second adventure into spiritualism during my association with the Sunday Pictorial, I want physical phenomena. Startling deeds, not words, as proof. Not testimonies of people claiming to be healed, not messages from the dead. Just material facts which a materially minded man like me can grasp. I want final and complete conviction. That is more important to me than Hitler, the Axis, or even the threat of war. And that is why I have asked the editor to allow me for a while to leave politics, and go in search of truth. So we sat, 14 of us, a cheerful, talkative group of very ordinary people, in a plainly furnished room at Balham, London. There was a metropolitan policeman, a consulting engineer, a waiter, a postman, a foreman plumber, several women of various ages, and next to me, between the medium and me, Mr. Harry Edwards, leader of the Balham Psychic Society, by trade a printer. We all held hands loosely. Mr. Weber settled himself back as comfortably as my knots would allow, and out went the light, leaving only a red bulb gleaming dully through the darkness from the middle of the room. Things began to happen immediately. They went on happening with remarkable rapidity, with startling variety, for 90 minutes. But I do not want to recount them in order. For I want to describe first two astonishing happenings which make the rest seem small in contrast. Happenings which I, personally, can only compare with the miracles of the New Testament. There was the appearance, in mid-air, so to speak, of a perfect human face. I am sitting, remember, only one removed from the medium. An hour of the séance has gone by. The early tenseness, the trace of excitement, which perhaps affected me at the start, has disappeared. I am my normal, cool, and vigilant self, alert for any sign of deception, accustomed to the eerie glimmer of light we get from the red bulb near the ceiling. In the corner, so near I can touch him, the medium is breathing heavily, gulping occasionally, moaning uneasily at times, like a man with a nightmare. Suddenly, he gurgles alarmingly, as if making some still greater effort. Before me rises a kind of tablet, rather like a slate, and from the upper surface it sheds a luminous white light. I watch it intently, not in the least perturbed. I saw it in its normal state before the séance started. An ordinary piece of four plywood, about a foot long and 9 inches wide. Now it hovers in front of the medium's face, its soft radiance lighting his features so clearly I can see the closed eyes and the twitching lips. It moves gently down to his hands and I see quite clearly that the arms are still bound to the chair. I tease showing you the medium to convince you he's still in the same position, Mr. Edwards explains, in a normal tone. Ah, you're really going to see something now. The glowing tablet has moved over to me. It hangs motionless so close to my face I feel that if I breathe hard I shall blow it away. 35. Watch, says Mr. Edwards, giving my hand a squeeze. Then above the tablet I begin to see something white emerging from the darkness. Almost invisible at first, it grows stronger every moment, like a motor car headlamp advancing through fog, until I can clearly see it as a diaphanous ellipse, standing on its end, as it were, on the tablet. "Ectoplasm," says Mr. Edwards. "Watch closely in the center of it. No need to tell me. My eyes are glued on it, though, I want to emphasize, I'm still cool and unemotional. Now, framed in this luminous halo, I can perceive dimly what appear to be features. They are becoming clearer, easier to trace. There's the nose, and, yes, the mouth. The eyes, and, my God, the eyelids are moving." The tablet moves still closer. The eyes, soft and natural, are looking directly into mine. I jerk myself back to a detached, inquisitive state of mind, examine the thing in front of me closely and searchingly. It's not like the pictures of spirit faces many of us have seen in spiritualist papers. It's not white and unearthly, like the frame in which it is set. Rather is it a human face, but softer, finer, and somehow different. I can trace the cheekbones fading back from the eyes. The lips, they are quite clear. The chin, rounded and delicate, is silhouetted against the lower rim of the halo. I recognize it suddenly as the face of a very old lady. Just like a lovely miniature, for it is much smaller, now I come to think, than the face of any human adult. "Try and speak to us," says Mr. Edwards, encouragingly. I am watching the lips. They part a little, move with an effort. 36. There's a whisper. What is she saying? Who is she speaking to? "Yes, I've got it. My boy," whispers a woman's voice, in the tone a wealth of love, or maybe compassion. "Who's she speaking to?" I ask, without taking my eyes off the face for a second. "You," replies Edwards. "Speak to her." "Who are you?" I ask, gently. "I am," she answers, and whispers a name I shall not repeat. "It is personal. I cannot stay," she goes on. "I just want you all to see me. God bless you, my boy." The tablet and its burden move away. I can see it floating around our circle. Other sitters are exclaiming that they can see it, quite plainly, that it's wonderful. I'm glad I'm not the only one. WHO can see it. The tablet returns to me. The features in the miniature are fading, like outlines yielding to the dusk of a summer evening. Now the halo is going too. Only the tablet is left. Its gleam disappears with the suddenness of a light being extinguished. The tablet falls with a clatter at my feet. "Lights on," says a voice instantly. There's the click of a switch. In less than 5 seconds the whole room is bathed in electric light. Everybody is in his or her place, holding hands. The medium is bound just the same in his chair, unconscious in his trance. And at my feet is the bit of common 4-ply wood. The deep voice which comes from the medium's corner, they call it the voice of Black Cloud, Weber's Indian spirit guide says, "I want the gentleman sitting next to Mr. Edwards to hold the medium's right hand. I want the lady on the left of the medium to hold his left hand." Edwards guides my hand over his knees to the hand of the medium. I feel my fingers seized in a powerful grasp. The pressure tightens till it hurts. I set my teeth and wait. 37. The medium is moaning like a man in pain. I can feel a soft fabric rubbing against my wrist. "Can you feel his coat?" asks the deep voice in the corner. "I can feel some kind of material on my wrist," I answer, readily. I am dematerializing his coat and taking it off. Now the coat is rubbing the other side of my wrist. Something drops to the floor with a light, rustling impact. "Lights on," says the voice sharply. Simultaneously, it seems, somebody presses the switch. The medium is in his shirt sleeves. He is no longer wearing his coat. Round his arms, over his shirt now, are the ropes, still fastened by my patent knots. The thin strands of cotton from the ropes to the chair are unbroken. On the floor, the medium's jacket. Not a stitch holding the edges together broken. My twisted thread round the button just as I had left it. That is merely intended to prove to you that the spirit world exists and has power to dematerialize, says the deep voice in the corner, when the lights are off again. Later I hope to replace the medium's coat. Half an hour later the lady on the other side and I are asked to hold Weber's hands a second time. Again the grip is firm enough to be painful. A rustling. Cloth rubbing against my wrist again. Yes, and now the other side. Lights. Weber is wearing his coat once more. Over and round each arm, the bonds. The cotton intact. The thread just as before. But the bonds and the cotton are over the coat. 38. My hand was gripped by his all the time, says the girl across from me, rubbing her fingers. And I felt the coat go through my wrist. Didn't you? Well, those two happenings, or miracles, call them what you like, take a bit of explaining away. There were other things too. Heaps of them. I can feel a hand on my head, said Mr. Edwards, casually, just as if it were quite a natural thing for a hand to emerge from nowhere. I can feel something on my head, I said a moment later, and gripped Edwards's hand more tightly to make sure it hadn't been raised. Something was pulling my hair pretty hard. I realized then with a sense of shock that the something was definitely fingers, yet rather different from human fingers. They felt sharper, more like claws, seemed almost metallic at the tips. My neighbor chuckled. I know what they're doing, he said, highly amused. The fingers pulled me firmly by the hair in Edwards's direction, till my head was touching his. My hair was pulled and twisted about for fully a minute. We're being tied together, said my neighbor, laughing. Can't you feel your hair being twisted with mine? We were tied together, too. We couldn't separate, and the séance was held up for a moment or two while the lights were put on so that we could be unraveled. A mischievous trick, said everybody else, laughing at our plight. Mischievous, all right. Inexplicable, too. I'll swear nobody moved before, during, or after the knots were tied in our hair. Frequently throughout the proceedings the luminous trumpets were shooting about the room three at a time, with the speed and accuracy of swallows in flight. I should like to be absolutely sure nobody is holding them, I said boldly, though I myself considered it impossible. 39. One of the trumpets shot straight at my head with the speed of an express train, pulled up sharp just as it touched my temple, and I cringed expecting a knockout blow. That tin cone proceeded to run itself on my face and round my head, pressing first the broad end, then the narrow end, against my lips to prove it had no earthly connection at any point on its surface. A bell which I'd seen on a table in a corner rose into the air and rang a rhythmic accompaniment to our singing. A pair of clappers, similar to those used by a dance band drummer, floated about clacking merrily in time with the music. In a powerful bass voice, which has been recorded on gramophone discs, Reuben led some of the singing. Toys in the room, illuminated by a strange incandescent glow, leapt from the table and sailed about near the ceiling. A boy, I was told, plays with the toys, a boy who died some years ago. As something moved off the table and began to dart about the room, Mr. Edwards explained that it was a doll. Whatever it was, it settled on my knee, and frolicked up and down my leg. I could feel it as well as see it glowing, like an outsized glowworm. It came to rest finally on my knee. And when the lights came on, I found that it was indeed a toy elephant, such as any child would use in play. You see, therefore, it wasn't a gloomy gathering by any means. The strange pranks with the toys, a clockwork engine wound itself up and ran itself down near the ceiling, distinctly enlivened the proceedings. All these little things, however, paled into insignificance beside a remarkable demonstration of furniture removing by unseen hands. 40. The heavy table in the corner, just behind me, rose straight up into the air, brushing my coat as IT passes IT, settled one leg lightly on my shoulder for a moment, was wafted right over to the other side of the room and descended to the floor with a distinct bang. I saw it in passage, because it was outlined against the red light. And of course there were spirit messages for some of the sitters. I do not want to write about them. In this series of articles I am concerned more with incidents. Well, that is my testimony. I cannot explain anything I saw. But every word I have written is true. And although many of my friends will think I've gone crazy, I say again, I saw it happen. Chapter 6, Critical Analysis of a Seance by Colin Evans. B.A. attended a group seance for physical phenomena with Jack Weber, on Monday, February 27, 1939. I was particularly alertly observant and more analytical and critical than, in my own experience as a medium, it is usually advisable to be, owing to the unhelpful mental radiations resulting from such an attitude. The only two sitters who might be supposed to have personal association with the medium or whom even a hostile skeptic might suspect of collusion, were Mr. Harry Edwards, the head of the Balham Psychic Research Society under whose auspices Weber sits and Weber's father-in-law. These two gentlemen were at points in the room most remote from the medium, the former at the very opposite end of the room, the latter in the diagonally opposite corner furthest from Weber, where the electric light control is. No phenomena occurred near enough to either of these gentlemen for it to be physically possible for them to play any part in it, and at no time, by any possible means, could either of them have left his position without the full knowledge of half the independent sitters. Neither of these gentlemen had any part in the roping and tying of the medium or the stitching of his coat. I sat by the door in the fourth seat from the medium. This seance was held in darkness. I scrutinized very closely the tying of the medium's arms and ankles to the chair by rope. Two men did this, and the knots tied and the tightness of the rope were such that no escape trickery was possible that would permit of getting back into the ropes without obvious disturbance of them. They cut closely into the flesh, and the muscles of arms and ankles were immovably secured to the solid wood of the chair, so that absolutely no movement of the feet or of the arms above the wrist was possible. And I made special note, without drawing attention to it, of the exact angle at which two looped portions of rope crossed one another under the forearm. Even had it been possible to slip the arm from this rope, and later to put it back, it would have been an utter and complete impossibility to arrange precisely the same angle of crossing of the rope there, except by using both hands to do so, and to be able to see clearly while doing it, and therefore an utter impossibility for the medium himself to achieve, in light or in darkness, or for any other person to accomplish in the dark. Before he was tied in the chair, his coat was stitched all down the front so that it was an absolutely tight fit that could not possibly be taken off or put on again, even if his arms had been free, without undoing the stitching. I examined the stitching, and noted trapeways it was caught and twisted round certain buttons that would have given away any interference made by resewing. After the seance, it took some minutes to cut away this stitching with scissors. The first movement of the trumpets occurred instantly on the light being put out. By instantly I mean an interval of about 1/10 of a second, judging that minute interval of time by my experience as a photographer fairly familiar with speeded camera shutters and exposures. These trumpets, about 2 feet in height and 2 in number and very plentifully daubed with luminous paint so that they were never lost sight of, had been standing on the floor well out of reach of the medium's hands where he was seated. First one trumpet soared swiftly up into the air, and then both trumpets simultaneously a moment later. The direction in which each trumpet pointed and its angle and the position of the unilluminated narrow ends could be quite accurately judged from the luminous portions owing to the distinctive shape of the luminous paint on the aluminum. They rose vertically till the broad ends were about 3 feet from the floor, then tilted over horizontally, and, mostly with the narrow ends towards the medium, moved freely in all directions away from him to distances of 7 or 8 feet, from the nearest part of the medium's chair to the broad ends of the trumpets, leaving about 5 or 6 feet between the nearest part of the medium's chair and the narrow end of the trumpets, but occasionally turned completely round and moved equally freely with the broad ends pointing towards him and the narrow ends away from him. No mechanical device of the nature of a rod or tongs could have produced this effect by any human possibility. They repeatedly tapped firmly on the bodies of the sitters, including myself, and on the medium's own head and body, and later in the seance soared to the full height of the room about 12 or 13 feet, knocking against the ceiling in the middle of the room, and against the walls at considerable distances from the medium, and sometimes at such distances from one another that no one person could simultaneously have been manipulating both trumpets, even if free to walk about and stand on chairs or the like.